Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, The Guardian's weekly gaze into the reassuringly troubled crystal ball of Brexit. This week, we'll be looking back at the EU's Brussels summit, at which Brexit played almost no part whatsoever, and forward to the Cabinet's Chequers Away Day, at which it will be the only subject of conversation. We'll debate whether or not the Prime Minister may have a looming political crisis on her hands, wonder what's in the government's long-awaited Brexit white paper, and, with summer recesses in Brussels and Westminster a little over a fortnight away, ponder what might happen over the next few weeks. In fact, if you take all those various breaks and holidays into account, there are now, it seems, just about 6 working weeks left in which to negotiate Brexit. So you'd have to hope that something will start happening sooner rather than later. Anyway, with me to discuss all this are Jennifer Rankin, The Guardian's Brussels correspondent, and someone who can tell a Max Fack from a fundamental freedom at 40 paces, plus Guardian columnist Raphael Baer, who's forgotten more about the way Westminster works than most people will ever know. Welcome to both of you. Let's kick off with the summit, shall we? Jennifer, I mean, this time the Europeans were really fairly blunt, weren't they? Jean-Claude Juncker, the Commission President, made it very clear. He said, we cannot go on living with a split cabinet. Our British friends have to say what they want. Leo Varadkar, the Irish leader, also helpfully pointing out that the UK really couldn't expect a relationship of equals after Brexit. Yeah, he made that very plain. We're 27 member states. The EU is one country. We're 500 million people. The UK is 60 million. That basic fact needs to be realised. And they also issued a grave warning of the threat of the UK leaving the bloc on the 29th of March next year without a deal or a transition period agreed. Was it all as bad-tempered as it sounded? Is patience really beginning to run thin?
Yes, well, I think patience is definitely running out. I mean, if we're sitting in pedant's corner, which we often are, we could fault Leo Varadkar's population figure slightly. He's forgotten to minus the UK population. But I think that the general point still stands, that the point he's really getting across is that EU will defend its member states. So a country of less than 5 million people, which Ireland is going to weigh more than a country that's decided to leave the EU. And that's the message that is coming through loud and clear and came through on that summit as well. I think it's worth to add the context that the Brexit discussion at the summit came after a very long and difficult debate on migration, which went all through the night until 4:30 in the morning. So it might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that Brexit is a welcome distraction, because it's certainly not welcome, but it is at least something that the EU's 27 leaders can, for the moment, agree on, and it's something that's sort of relatively easy to unite the bloc on. So I wouldn't exactly say, well, I'd say bad-tempered. Time is certainly running out, and patience is running out. But I don't think it's certainly not something that's causing the most angst in the EU at the moment.
No, for sure. But they were certainly plainer spoken than they.
Yes, there were some very blunt warnings, and really Donald Tusk laying it on the line at the press conference, saying it's time for the UK to put its cards on the table. And seeing that also in the diplomatic language of the communique, the UK is asked to come up with realistic and workable proposals. And I think this just shows the impatience that so far, that after 2 years after the referendum, these workable and realistic proposals from the EU's point of view just simply don't exist.
I think that's a very important distinction there, in terms of what is workable from the EU's point of view. I mean, I think that, you know, the UK sort of official side would say, well, we've sort of told you what we want. It's just not available.
It's not on offer. Yeah.
So, you know, you had to remember at the beginning of the year, there was this, the sort of the three baskets model, where you sort of divide the single market up into different sort of silos, some of which the UK would be in, some of which wouldn't be in. That got kicked into touch. The various sort of customs proposals, the customs partnership has already been shot down preemptively, this idea that the UK might want to sort of take the Akibi part of the single market for goods, but carve out special exceptions for services. That's basically been preemptively killed. So it's not exactly that the UK hasn't said what it wants. It's just that what it wants doesn't seem to tally with an EU27 collective understanding of how their interests are protected. And those interests are protected by maintaining entirely the integrity of the single, of the common market, and as Jennifer said, upholding solidarity at 27, which means putting Irish interest as a member state ahead of any perceived third country, even if it's a big powerful one like the UK.
Yeah, exactly. And Raphael, I mean, there was one area where Britain apparently at least still feels that it might have some leverage, which is security. And it was quite striking, I thought, that, you know, Theresa May clearly chose to fight back, really, with a warning that EU leaders' intransigence, as she said, was putting citizens' lives at risk by jeopardising any sort of form of information sharing or advanced information sharing on security. That didn't seem to go down too well. I mean, I'm just wondering, you wrote this week about how pro-European liberals feel about Brexit, and the kind of the would-be EU wreckers in Britain in the age of Trump. Is it wise, I mean, just tactically, for the Prime Minister sort of to go on the attack in these circumstances?
The short answer is no, but it's a very interesting kind of paradox. In a way, it is definitely true that, or it certainly was definitely true at the beginning of the process, that the UK's security and intelligence and military capability was a card in the negotiations. Obviously, strategically, other European countries, I mean, France is a very big military power, so by European standards. Germany, for all complicated historical reasons, squeamish about military power. There really isn't another equivalent one. And so actually the UK security capability does weigh in the negotiations, but it's only a card if you don't play it, so to speak.
Okay,
because
it's
known and understood in the background. But the moment the UK basically does this slightly kind of mafiosi, that's a nice continent you've got there, it'd be a shame if anything were to happen to it, kind of, you know, threatening to withhold its capability, then it really aggravates that sense among the other 27 that really the UK is this slightly kind of maverick, Trumpian, unreliable partner, not necessarily on the side of Europe in the broader sense. And actually, this was played out right at the very beginning of the process in the letter that was sent activating Article 50. If you remember, there was a little paragraph in there, more or less making that implicit threat, saying, you know, we care about security, we think you do too, so, you know, just watch it. And the Prime Minister was very strongly recommended not to do that, and it is now
or at least not to link it
explicitly, exactly. And this is now, it was then understood very quickly to have been a mistake to take that tone. And I think it's just sort of desperation now that that tone's crept back into it. It's not a strategic way to handle it at all.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Showdown at Chequers this week, if you believe the hype, at least. And it's true, isn't it? I think that, in a process that has known a great many crunch moments, this one feels somehow a little bit crunchier than most. May gathers her whole cabinet at her country retreat on Friday to try to thrash out some kind of common vision of the future relationship between the EU and the UK after Brexit. All the signs are it's not really going to be a walk in the park. Jennifer, in an ideal world, what would Brussels like to see come out of this meeting?
Well, it does come back to this phrase of realistic and workable proposals. I think that's the key thing that's come out of this recent summit. And the feeling here is that for a long time the UK has been saying what it would like from Brexit, but its own red lines are in contradiction with its actions. So, for example, the government will say, well, we're going to leave the customs union. And people on this side will say, well, hang on a second, where are all your lorry car parks at your port? Where are all the new customs officers that are going to be in place? Equally, the UK will say, well, we're leaving the single market, but actually we'd really like to be in the EU agency for aviation and then for medicines as well. And people say here, well, hang on a second, that's not really what we have in mind when we talk about leaving the single market. So there's this consistent sense from the EU 27 that the UK position is full of contradictions and that they want to have everything all at once. The have your cake and eat it model is the phrase that everyone loves now goes. And so that's what Brussels really wants to see an end to. They want the UK to face up to the consequences of the decision to leave. That's how it's seen here, that the UK government has so far failed to do that. And what they're afraid of is that this meeting in Chequers is again going to result in some kind of ambiguous, fudgy compromise to keep the government together, but isn't going to actually move the negotiations forward. So there's a sense that Theresa May is all tactics and no strategy, that she's very good at surviving from one day to the next, but she doesn't really know how she's going to negotiate her way to a Brexit deal. And the fear for people here is that then you have a lost summer, that nothing happens, that the negotiations continue to stall, and then you're in a very risky position in the autumn, and that raises the chance of a no deal.
Exactly. Things start to get really very tight indeed. Raphael, I mean, is there any way of bridging this divide between the cabinet leavers and remainers? I mean, you know, we've heard talk this week of Michael Gove tearing up customs union papers and Jacob Rees-Mogg practically giving May her orders in the Telegraph just this morning, businesses increasingly making their voices heard. I mean, the pressure is really, I mean, it's a pressure cooker in there, isn't it?
It is. But as you say, I mean, we have sort of been through this sort of pantomime before in a run up to these sorts of decisions. And interestingly, what has tended to happen is the leavers get very frenzied and agitated and say, you absolutely mustn't compromise on X, Y, and Z. And actually, they sort of do. They fold eventually. May has called their bluff quite a lot. I mean, going back to sort of November, December, or even earlier last summer, when there should be no money at all paid to the EU. There should be, there are all sorts of things that actually the leavers have compromised on. Now, it has been sort of suggested, and I've heard it from ministers, that May's strategy is exactly to game that, to just keep just nudging it forward.
One day at a time.
One day at a time. The comparison that's used is sort of boiling the frog. You know, if you put a frog in water and turn the temperature up gradually, it doesn't notice until it's boiled, doesn't leap out. Another one that's used is the sort of the rope-a-dope. You know, Muhammad Ali basically going to the ropes and letting George Foreman hit him until he was exhausted, and then in sort of the 8th, 9th, 10th round coming out and knocking him out. I mean, Theresa May is no Cassius Clay, that's for sure. But there is a sense that if Theresa May can just sort of keep stringing the levers along and then taking them, drawing them into little compromises here and there, eventually, before you know it, they've got a choice between a soft Brexit or possibly no Brexit at all. And they'll just be so exhausted, they'll just sign up to anything and then hope to try and, you know, correct it or dot the I's and cross the T's after next March. But the problem is, ultimately, you do come to the point where you have to decide whether or not you're taking the acquis, whether or not you're, you know, a rule taker in the single market or not,
whether you're Norway or Canada or plus
Norway
or minus or whatever.
Exactly. And that's the bottom line. And you get this strong feeling that actually Theresa May has essentially internalise the economic argument for Norway, but cannot see a political way beyond Canada. And so there is a crisis. There is going to be a political crisis in this country over that question. I think it's almost certain.
And certainly, surely when you get also to the parliamentary party, isn't it? Then I mean, there was just another letter over the weekend, a classic one of these sort of shackled to the EU type letters signed by Andrea Jenkins. And I think nearly 40 sort of hardline backbenchers. I mean, really insisting that Theresa May stick to red lines that if she did would guarantee a no deal, a catastrophic kind of crashing out. I mean, how there is no mollifying these people, is there?
No. The question, what it really comes down to, is how many of those people actually are so fundamentalist in this, so radicalised, that actually they would
either bring
the government down or genuinely take the UK into a no-deal scenario, which actually is quite a serious thing to do. I mean, they talk about it very gamely. But in reality, when you're really confronting that prospect, how many of them would actually peel off more into what we understand to be the kind of Michael Gove position, which is a little bit more just basically get anything, put it in a box, stick a ribbon on it, call it Brexit, and then worry about the details afterwards. That I think that position has a lot more support in the Parliamentary Conservative Party than is generally advertised.
That's interesting.
But, sorry, one other important point is the problem that Theresa May has is Labour will almost certainly have to vote against any deal politically. They cannot be seen to just sort of nod through a Tory Brexit.
They are the opposition, aren't
they? They are the opposition, ultimately. And Jeremy Corbyn is coming under so much pressure now for being a bit too Brexity. I think Labour will vote against the deal. So Theresa May, she really does need those 40 to 50 MPs. So they do actually have a lot of leverage.
Interesting. Jennifer, now one thing the Cabinet is supposed to sign off on at Chequers is, of course, the government's famous Brexit white paper. Now, you wrote about that this week. Brussels apparently has had a sight of it, or at least of an early draft. Nobody was too impressed, were they? Leo Varadkar again was very clear during the summit, I think, wasn't he? He basically said whatever the government comes up with, it really has to offer what he called new thinking. But it doesn't seem to, does it, at the moment at least?
Yes, that's right. And people who here in Brussels who have seen drafts, as you say, have not been impressed by what they've seen. They think it all amounts to classic UK cherry-picking, this idea that Raphael mentioned earlier, that the UK could stay in a single market for goods while having more flexibility and freedom on services, but also restrictions on free movement of people. And it really comes back to this fundamental question for the EU. It's almost like the Brexit equivalent of splitting the atom. Can you have free movement of goods and services without having, say, free movement of people? And the EU has said all along that's just not possible. And Michel Barnier has been observing this line very strictly, and so far he's been backed up by all the member states. But I think it is worth pointing out again that the member states haven't really had to confront a UK proposal. So it hasn't really been a source of division for them. And I think for the EU, a soft Brexit will be much, much harder to negotiate. A hard Brexit is very easy. No Brexit is easy as well. They might be both, of course, politically deeply unpalatable for the EU, but they're much simpler to negotiate, whereas negotiating a soft Brexit halfway house agreement is much harder, which is why I think so far Barnier has really wanted to stress to the UK that there are only these options. It's either Canada or Norway, and there isn't another off-the-shelf model to be invented. And the British government will keep trying to invent some sort of new model. And it may be that further along the line, the EU countries will look at this more closely. But I don't think this is something that's going to emerge before Brexit Day. I think this will really be a question that has to be gone into in much more detail after Brexit has happened, and the expectations for the trade deal or a preliminary trade deal that will emerge in the autumn really have to be very limited.
Raphael, any thoughts on this famous doc? I mean, we've been waiting for it for long enough, haven't we? Any thoughts on what it might?
Well, certainly the last thing I heard from within Whitehall was that it would be sort of disappointing and unremarkable from the point of view of those who are expecting something interesting.
Quelle surprise.
And as Jennifer said, that you know, the most dynamic movement in the UK position does appear to be this idea that seems to be based quite heavily on at least a sort of a landing zone that was first identified by Ivan Rogers, the UK's former ambassador to Brussels, who resigned last year.
Just before he was pushed.
The sticking point is dividing the four freedoms. But also, I think Jennifer makes a very good point. And actually, the UK is a very special case. It's a very big country. It's a big market for the EU. Some of those arguments that the Leavers brought about where the UK has notional leverage, and going back to the conversation we were having earlier about security as well, you know, if you imagine the sort of counterfactual where the UK has played its diplomatic cards much better and arrived at a position where it was saying, well, I'll tell you what, how about single market in goods, a little bit of capacity on services, the sort of deal on free movement that you almost gave David Cameron but didn't in his renegotiation. You know, we're basically a rule taker. We'll pay you a bunch of money. It's basically good for you because you've got the surplus in goods. That's kind of win for you. We get something called Brexit. We get notional freedom. It's actually a pretty good deal. If they could have articulated that proposition better, then the EU side would have been in a much stickier position. They would have found it, a lot of member states would have found it quite hard to say no.
Quite an attractive
The Dutch and the
offer.
Germans, a lot of people would be saying, well, let's take this. This isn't actually a bad deal for us. The problem is the scorching evaporation of goodwill and the total absence of political bandwidth on the EU side, because, as Jennifer mentioned, we're dealing with the migration crisis. You've got this new government in Italy, third biggest country in the Eurozone, absolute nightmare in terms of just administrating the whole project. But yeah, as an official said to me very recently, the sort of the depressing thing about this from a UK official point of view is that, seen from Brussels, Brexit's the thing that's going quite well for the EU, because at least there is a system.
It's locked into something.
There's a method it's working in, a 27 that speak as one.
There's a path to be followed, yes. Okay, let us look forward a little bit. We are heading into the quiet summer months. Both parliaments, Brussels and Westminster, go into recess, as I said, in a fortnight's time or so. How are things going to move on, or are they going to move on at all over the summer, Jennifer? I mean, Brussels presumably goes pretty much into summer hibernation like most of the continent, doesn't it? And there's precious little, as you said, preoccupation with Brexit anyway. Nothing much is going to happen in July and August, is it?
Yes, I think people here are more sort of more anxious about a potential political crisis over migration during the summer than Brexit. But nonetheless, the wheels on Brexit will keep turning, and the officials who work on Brexit are at pains to stress they won't all be disappearing to the beach for a month. And I think the technical talks will continue, but we won't see much on a political front. And I think now the expectations are really looking to October, which will be a really, I mean, we have the cliche the crunch time, which is overused, but it really will come down to October, because at the midway through October there will be the next EU summit
the 18th,
sort of penciled in as the moment when the Brexit deal should happen.
Is there any leeway after that at all? I mean, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of
well, I potential? Think there is, actually, because people here, it hasn't gone unnoticed that summit comes very hard on the heels of the Conservative Party conference. There's about a 2.5 week difference. And again, people are just not sure whether Theresa May will be in a position to make the compromises. I think mentally, there's already a November Brexit summit being penciled into people's minds. And even suggestions that perhaps it will happen in December at that sort of final summit of the year, which is on the calendar. But I think it's hard to see how it would go beyond this year, because there is a very hard legal stop on the 29th of March next year. And then you do have to jump over a number of hoops, sort of getting the text sort of cleared by lawyers and linguists and translated into all the EU's official languages. So I think the end of this year, the final 3 months will be crucial. Probably there will be slippage, as there always is in Brussels. So I think October, November, these will really be the decisive moments for Brexit.
Okay, and Raphael, then finally, you said there will be at some stage be a political crisis inevitably. Is it going to come over the summer?
Well, the interesting thing about summer is obviously the MPs aren't in Parliament and aren't around, and that actually gives. It sort of gives number 10 a bit of breathing space, because if the MPs aren't all kind of gathering together in the bars and in the tea rooms, they're not conspiring. although it does also give people opportunities to try and get in the headlines, because it gets a bit quiet. You get silly season, which has increasingly morphed into kind of stupid angry season. So there'll be a bit of that. I do think ultimately, though, it just comes down to this question of there is no visible bridge now between a Brexit that is available through the negotiation as it's currently formulated in Brussels and what domestically Theresa May can get past the Conservative Party in one piece. And so at some point, something's going to have to snap. Now, what that looks like is hard to say. I mean, people obviously speculate about the general election, which always tends to happen just because if people can't think of anything else that will change, then that's
there's going to be an election.
That's your go-to way of sort of detonating everything. Yeah. It's like a sort of, I don't know, sort of Van de Graaff generator. If it sort of builds up enough negative ions, at some point the spark will leap and something will change. A not impossible scenario also is an extraordinary one where you get a vote of no confidence in Theresa May as leader of the Conservative Party, triggered by angry Tory MPs, which she then wins. And so she is then reinstalled.
Comes out even stronger then.
Comes out stronger. Or better still, you get a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, which then triggers a vote of no confidence in the government, which she somehow wins. You know, so you there are all sorts of ways
permutations where you can get
to the brink. It, ultimately, as I said earlier, it will come down to the question of how many fundamentalists there are who in the Conservative Party who care about nothing other than the hardest possible Brexit. And my gut still is that there are fewer of them than a lot of them are all talk, basically.
Okay. All right. Well, we shall see. That's about it then for this week and for a while, in fact. Brexit Means is itself going to be taking a bit of a summer break, but we'll be back in a slightly new format, I think, in September. In the meantime, our sister podcast, Politics Weekly, will be keeping you up to date with any and all Brexit-related developments through the summer. And do feel free, please, to email us whenever you like at brexitpodcast.com. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. My thanks to Jennifer and Raphael for joining me. Till next time then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Simon Barnard. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.